Welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. Today we'll look at a number of subjects in the news. We'll begin in a moment and speak with Hugh Kaufman, who is a senior policy analyst at the Environmental Protection Agency's Office of Solid Waste and Emergency Response. He is one of the core group that founded the EPA, having worked for the agency for the last 35 years. And he was the chief EPA investigator for the post 9/11 emergency response. And we'll be talking to him about the response to Hurricane Katrina, where already there is friction between the mayor of New Orleans, who's allowing people to return, and the new FEMA director, Admiral Loy. So we'll be talking about what perhaps is in the environment, the toxic stew that is in New Orleans, how hazardous it will be to those responders and those returning perhaps prematurely. We'll also speak with Professor Peter Edelman, who has been a professor of law at Georgetown University since 1982. He's previously was associate dean of Georgetown University's Law Center, and he was a clerk to Supreme Court Justice Arthur Goldberg. We'll be talking to him about the John Roberts hearings this week and the possibility that he will become, or the probability that he will become, the new Chief Justice, and who might replace Senator O'Connor, and whether that's where the real battle will be fought. We'll also speak with James Paul, who has been the Executive Director of the Global Policy Forum since its foundation in 1993. He's also, since 1997, has served as the chair of the NGO, that's the non-governmental organizations working group at the United Nations Security Council. We talked to him about the efforts to reform the United Nations and the summit that took place this last week, and the extent to which it were, the original plans were watered down, and what the U.S. got and what the rest of the world got, and we'll look into that. I'm speaking with Hugh Kaufman, who is a senior policy analyst at the Environmental Protection Agency's Office of Solid Waste and Emergency Response. He is one of the core group that founded the EPA, and he's been with the agency for 35 years. He was the chief EPA investigator for the post 9/11 emergency response, and we're talking obviously about Katrina and the response to both in terms of the FEMA response, but also the environmental aspects of this vast toxic stew that is, as the water is pumped into Lake Pontchartrain as it happens, the residue clearly contains bacterial waste and also lots of toxic chemicals and lots of gasoline. And but just on, let me just begin, if I can, Hugh Kaufman, and I take it you're speaking as a citizen rather than as a spokesperson for the EPA.
Correct. I'm not a spokesman for the administration. I'm speaking based on my 35 years' experience dealing with cases like this.
But you still are a government employee.
Yes, I still work at the EPA on solid waste and emergency response.
And just a general question about government. I mean, it seems to me that in the last few weeks, our government has discovered the fact that it is a government.
Well, I think a lot of the politicians have been called on to deliver the civilian services that the taxpayers have been paying the government billions of dollars to deliver those services. And I think on national television, a lot of people have been watching to see that the billions of dollars of tax money that they've paid for protection and remediation after a major catastrophe, whether it's terrorist-made or natural occurring, just isn't there.
Well, much was made of the looting that followed the hurricane, and But, you know, you can make the case that it's penny ante compared to the extent to which the Treasury has been opened to these large contractors who have been the main beneficiaries of the war in Iraq. Nobody can argue that the Iraqi people are getting are better off, and arguably the United States is much worse off for the Iraq war. But $6 billion are being spent a month, about 40% that at least goes in the hands of private contractors. And lo and behold, it turns out that the same private contractors who are profiting from Iraq are going to be the main contractors down in New Orleans. So without being too provocative, there's penny ante looting and there's wholesale looting.
Well, I mean, a lot of commentators have been pointing out the fact that it appears that, among other catastrophic situations caused by Katrina, is that there will be billions and billions of dollars looted from the Treasury to contractors that will ultimately find its way into their wallets and bank accounts, while the people doing the work to actually remediate and rebuild will be paid slave wages. I don't know if your listeners know about this, but one of the first acts after Katrina hit, taken by the administration, was to have the president abolish the Davis-Bacon Act, which means the workers that are going to be doing the hard, heroic work of remediation and cleanup and rebuilding are going to be paid slave wages. The Davis-Bacon Act requires that people doing work must be paid prevailing wage, which would be like around $9 an hour. But that's been abolished. So the profits to these profiteers, who are very well politically connected, will be infinitely more than they are in the Iraq situation.
And you oversaw the cleanup of the 9/11 site.
Yes, we investigated that. At the time, I was the chief investigator for the ombudsman, and the congressman from the district that was impacted, Congressman Nadler, asked us to investigate that situation because it seemed to be falling apart, and the government was providing false information to the public about safety that could lead to basically cancer and major health effects down the line. And so we did the investigation of that situation after 9/11.
But you've said about that investigation that the government didn't do its job properly and provided the responders with the proper clothing and equipment like respirators, and now over 75% of the responders are as sick as dogs, and they're starting to die off 4 years after the heroic efforts in responding to 9/11.
That's correct. That has been documented by Mount Sinai Hospital, who have been monitoring the deterioration of the health of the heroes, the firefighters, the police, the cleanup workers, the iron workers who heroically, for no pay, started tearing down the iron works so that we could retrieve bodies and do cleanup and remediation.
So is any repeat of this likely to happen in New Orleans, given, first of all, you've established that the people who are going to be doing the work are going to be paid slave labor? Will these contractors provide the proper protective clothing and, if needed, respirators?
Well, anyone who's watched television and sees all of the heroes down there, the National Guard folks, the police, the military folks who are going in to rescue people, none of them are wearing respirators, nor are they wearing protective clothing that's waterproof that will keep the toxic water off of their bodies. So the documentation that it's deja vu all over again, as Yogi Berra said, is on your TV screen every night.
Well, it's been established, at least a good series of articles have been done by the South Florida Sun Sentinel looking into Hurricane Andrew and actually Hurricane Francis, which was last year when FEMA distributed $31 million in Hurricane Francis relief to Miami-Dade County residents who experienced no hurricane conditions. And they went on to further investigate from FEMA's activities from 1999 through 2004, responding to various natural disasters. Of the 1.2 billion FEMA's paid in these disasters, 27% went to areas where official reports showed only minor damage or none at all. So, we seem to have layers of possibility here of fraud, abuse, and waste. On the macro level, you've got the fact that most of the money is going through the hands of contractors, and then you've got FEMA who are giving out credit cards with limits that seem to be a moving target. And already a newspaper down in Florida has looked into what's happened down there, and a lot of that money ends up as political patronage paid into areas that weren't affected but are likely to vote Republican. So what's your feeling about the post-Katrina in terms of it being, you know, I mean, we all saw for the first time an American underclass. At least most of people in America saw it. And I had a woman, Congresswoman Watson, on recently from the Congressional Black Caucus, who was extremely upset about what was happening down there. But the question I put to her was, you know, are these people going to vote? And apparently 40% of the minorities in the South are still not registered. So is there, I mean, now I'm going on a bit, but is there a political dimension to aid where you actually give the money to people that you, your people, as opposed to their people?
Well, to be honest with you, I'm really not a politician, nor, you know, am I a political pundit. I'm not one of those blathering talking heads.
Well, that's a blessing.
Television. I'm an engineer who basically has responded and is aware of responses to these types of cases for the last 35 years. Obviously, from a moral point of view, I think money that is provided for response should go to the poor folks who are suffering, and should also go to the folks who are going to do the hard and dangerous work of not only picking up bodies and cleaning up, but also trying to restore the area. That's just based on a moral issue. Whether, in fact, this government mechanism that's being put in place will respond morally to the situation now that everybody has seen how immoral things were, or whether it'll be business as usual, which is the big money will go to the fat cats and the people taking the risks and or being harmed will be lucky to see chump change. I don't know. I think if the media continues to cover what's really going on, as opposed to putting all those politicians on TV who have an axe to grind or a political point to make, then I think the chances of the folks who are suffering and doing the risky business, more money will go to them. But if the media coverage degrades either to nothing or to just a bunch of wealthy white guys in Washington stating political points and sitting on boards of directors of multi-billion dollar companies that are will be and are legally looting the Treasury, then you'll have a different response.
Well, already the administration has made efforts to shift the blame both to state and local officials, but also to environmentalists, accusing the environmentalists of being responsible for not allowing a lot of the necessary levee work and Outer Island Barrier work to be done. We have a similar case here in California where a solar bill was just passed to encourage people building solar power into their homes and developments, and it was scuttled by the governor, who is anti-labor. The press has spun it in this state to blame labor for the collapse of a good environmental law, when in fact it's the governor who's anti-labor. And if you don't want working people to join the middle class, it seems to me that, you know, that's a sort of un-American position to take. But, you know, there's a division here between working people and sort of well-off environmentalists that some mendacious politicians are trying to exploit.
Well, I think mendacious politicians are a type of species that is hardly endangered in this society, but in fact is growing by leaps and bounds. But notwithstanding that issue, in fact, the Department of Justice sent out to the South Gulf States areas emails to their U.S. attorneys asking them to provide documentation so they could use it to prove that environmentalists caused the problems in New Orleans, when in fact, not only is that not true, but in fact, many Corps of Engineers projects done for the financial interest of the business community, the big business community down there, probably caused a substantial amount of the problems, as opposed to the environmentalists. But, hopefully the media will start to cover that issue. Right now, the only coverage that has occurred on that spin doctoring to shift the blame from the big corporations using the Corps of Engineers to their benefit causing that problem has been written by the Jackson, Mississippi Clarion Ledger.
And they obtained a copy of this Department of Justice memo that was just sent out to all U.S. attorneys' offices, and it's quoting the memo from the Justice Department. Has your district defended any case on behalf of the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers against claims brought by environmental groups seeking to block or otherwise impede the Corps' work on the levees protecting New Orleans? If so, please describe the case and outcomes of the litigation. So there it is in black and white. And I agree with you that it's a small paper, but maybe other people will pick it up. But
I think you've got to understand where things are heading. The President of the United States has identified a person, a czar, if you will, to be responsible for the restoration and remediation and cleanup after the hurricanes. He did not pick an engineer. He did not pick somebody experienced in this area, of which there are lots. He picked his chief spin doctor, Karl Rove. And so I think that pretty much gives the public an understanding of what this is really all about. What's also interesting about that is that selection of Karl Rove to be the czar for the remediation and restoration was buried in a New York Times story. It has not been publicized by the mainstream media.
Well, it's not different. I mean, we were talking earlier about how a lot of this disaster money ends up as political patronage, going not to the people that were affected, but to patronage to get Republican votes. If ever there was a man who's a political operator that knows how to get his voters out, there's Karl Rove. So it seems to me it's almost breathtaking that you could not expect some mischief here.
Well, until the mainstream national media on CNN, ABC, NBC, CBS publicize that outrageous decision, things will continue on, because the general public really does not have the factual information they need to fully understand what's going on. That's why it was so shocking to the general public when they saw who was being affected by this catastrophe on their TV sets. Now, those of us who have done casework around the country dealing with environmental justice issues, because these folks have been harmed by other environmental issues besides Katrina, know exactly, you know, what's going on and what can happen. But the public doesn't know, because they're getting the usual pablum of talking heads that either don't know what they're talking about or spin the truth to the financial and political benefit of their benefactors.
Well, let's just get in closing then, Hugh Kaufman. You're one of the founders of the EPA. You're still in the agency after 35 years, and you're the senior policy analyst for the Environmental Protection Agency's Office of Solid Waste and Emergency Response. You handle the 9/11 response and the environmental consequences of it, and you feel that the justice wasn't done there, and there was a cover-up. So give me a quick sense of what we've already been through in the context of whether or not this is going to repeat itself down in New Orleans.
Well, it's repeating itself right now. For example, many of the business interests of the big corporations want an appearance on TV of back to normal. So the mayor said, people can start coming back, even though what limited data has been taken documents the fact that it's a poisonous environment. The air, the land, the dust is all seriously contaminated with bacteria, viruses, fungus, toxic materials. Luckily, the news media has been publicizing that over the last 2 weeks. So the new head of FEMA, the head of the Coast Guard, now has publicly questioned the mayor's decision to bring people back so swiftly. There has been good coverage of the ridiculousness of the attempted cover-up, but people are going back in there without respirators, without protection, and don't know that they're running the risk of 5, 10 years down the line of getting cancer, birth defects, etc. It's really the World Trade Center cover-up situation all over again.
But I understood that one of the reasons why this area of the world was so polluted is because of corrupt politics. Governor Edwards eventually was caught after decades of misrule and personal enrichment. The whole place was an environmental disaster, wasn't it? With the incursion into the wetlands for the oil companies, the diversion of the rivers so that the silt didn't go to the Barrier Islands, and the fact that there's a huge dead zone off the in the Gulf there at the end of the Mississippi from all the pesticides that have been coming down the Mississippi for the last several decades.
Well, that's true, and that's why there's an old saying down that part of the country that half the state is underwater and the other half is under indictment.
Well, on that note, Hugh Kaufman, I thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you, sir.
Bye-bye. Hello again, I'm Ian Masters. I was just speaking then with Hugh Kaufman, who's a senior policy analyst at the Environmental Protection Agency's Office of Solid Waste and Emergency Response. He is one of the core group that founded the EPA, having worked there for the last 35 years, and he was in charge of the 9/11 cleanup, which he feels was done at the expense of the health and lives of the first responders, and is fearful that the same will repeat itself down in Texas, in New Orleans, and also that the people down in New Orleans that will be doing the heavy lifting will all be being paid slave wages because the president has revoked the Davis-Bacon Act. Let's now go to the subject of John Roberts, who is this week was appeared before the Senate Judiciary Committee as President Bush's nominee to become the new Chief Justice, replacing William Rehnquist. And, of course, this by about Thursday of this week, I think, there'll be a vote on his nomination. I'm speaking with Professor Peter Edelman, who has been on the faculty of the Georgetown Law School since 1982. He was also previously the Associate Dean of the Law Center at Georgetown University, and he's been closely watching the confirmation hearings of John Roberts for the Chief Justice of the United States Supreme Court. And the reviews are pretty unanimous that the Justice Roberts, or soon to be, or perhaps inevitably to be, Chief Justice Roberts, equipped himself very well. How did it strike you, though, that over half of the senators, the Republicans, basically told him not to say anything? I mean, I thought that the role of the Senate was to have oversight and advise and consent. It just seemed to me counterintuitive and against the whole idea of separation of powers that senators should encourage a witness not to talk.
It's unfortunate. The process is a difficult one because I don't think we want the senators pushing the nominee to promise how he or she will decide particular cases. And at the same time, we not want to know as much as possible about the judicial philosophy and approach of the nominee. In this case, we have a long record that goes all the way back to the early 1980s, in which we know a great deal about Judge Roberts. So that, in fact, I think that the process has focused more than it really needs to on whether he did or didn't answer the specific questions, although I must say he did a very good job of not answering the specific questions.
Yeah, it was as though they were reading him the Miranda. You know, you have a right to remain silent. Anything you say will be used against you.
If the Democrats could have added together everything that's in the record about Judge Roberts and made full use of it, then they could have pushed harder and talked more by inference of what that is likely to mean for his decision-making. The problem here is that you have another shoe that hasn't dropped, and the Democrats are in kind of a dilemma. And I'm talking about the appointment to replace Justice O'Connor. And some of them who come from states where their election hangs in the balance, perhaps having to run for re-election next year, are looking at it and saying, you know, when we replace Chief Justice Rehnquist with Judge Roberts, we don't create that much difference, although I personally think Judge Roberts is even more conservative than Chief Justice Rehnquist. But in any case, the nomination that will specifically tip the balance if it's terribly conservative is the next one. And you have to take that into account in understanding the reaction of the Democrats here to this process.
So if they're keeping their powder dry for the big fight on the replacement, nevertheless, it seems to me that the one question that they could have asked, which is pretty obvious, is that given the disquiet amongst conservative Republicans about Justice Souter, the notion being that, and of course you can go back to Eisenhower's choice of Earl Warren, quite often presidents think they're choosing a conservative justice and end up with a liberal one, and that is the kind of rallying cry for conservative Republicans vis-a-vis Souter. We don't want another Souter. So it seems to me a reasonable assumption that the White House knew exactly what they were getting with Judge Roberts, and he spent a lot of time with them. So why is it that the justice was able to share with the people who are appointing him what his parameters, legal parameters are, and not to share it with the Senate?
Well, again, whatever someone says in confidence is not on the public record, so it's just sort of not comparable. On the other hand, I think you're absolutely right that the president knows exactly what he's getting with Judge Roberts, and he's getting what he wants, and it will not be another suitor. Judge Roberts has a record, on the record, long list of statements and actions in relation to civil rights and civil liberties and access of ordinary Americans to the courts for the things that they need, and the ability of the government to overreach and hold people at Guantanamo without adequate due process, and just on and on, you know, the whole question of how the Constitution views women in our society, the power of Congress to protect consumers in a variety of ways, workers in a variety of ways. Those things are all on the record. And I am disappointed that there was not more done to bring all of that out. Even if he doesn't answer now, or he says now, as he did, oh, well, I was a young man, or I was just working for somebody else when I said that. That's not true. He was initiating, or he was asked an open-ended question, and he gave ultra-conservative advice to the right of the Reaganauts over and over again. Ted Olson, you know, who was then and now in the government, very conservative man, overruled him on a number of issues, like on the reenactment of the Voting Rights Act in 1982. Bradford Reynolds, a very conservative man, as the head of civil rights then, overruled Mr. Roberts as he was then. And we did not hear as a country all of that in a clear way in this process, and that's disappointing to me.
Well, also the senators didn't have access to all of the papers from the time that he was served under Bush's father, George Herbert Walker Bush, as assistant to the Solicitor General.
That's quite right. There's a missing set of pieces there, and I think that's significant. The Democrats certainly referred to it a number of times, but in fact, there's a lot in terms of his actions as the, you know, he was what's called the political deputy. Right there in that office, that tells you something about what his role was meant to be. They didn't have that until the 1980s in the Solicitor General's office. And they now it's clear and open that they have someone who's there to represent the interests of the administration in coming up with positions on the Constitution. That's exactly what his job was.
Well, in other words, the Senate are about to approve a Supreme Court Chief Justice whose entire political career has been an advocate for the executive branch. And I noticed that that Senator Specter, the chair of the committee, did talk about how the Congress is being, its powers are being challenged by the Supreme Court and by the executive branch. So again, it gets you back to the idea of what's wrong with these senators? Why don't they stand up for their own institution?
I think that what we're talking about here is the fact that, unfortunately, this is an artifact of the fact that President Bush won the election and that they have a solid majority in the Senate, and that's the bottom line. I think that in Judge Roberts, many people see his intelligence, which is genuine. They see his interpersonal relationships, his integrity. Those things are all there. This is a debate about how we interpret the Constitution, whether we're going to have people on the court who want to turn the clock back. And this is what I think we have here and what worries me a great deal, and I hope I'm wrong, but really want to turn the clock back 50 years in terms of civil rights, 75 years in terms of the power of the national government to help people through, help workers and help consumers as far as the Commerce Clause is concerned, and even in some respects back to the jurisprudence of a century ago, which I had thought which I know we had spent decades moving away from. So this is dangerous stuff, and we're operating in territory where this is the consequence of the electoral process. I think people ought to understand that what's going on now relates to who they elected to be the president and to be in the Senate, and that ought to give people some pause. Other people are very happy about it, for sure.
Well, it'd be worth finding out what percentage in whether people understand that perhaps they're voting against their own rights. They may not be aware of the consequences. Just run us through, if you would. Again, Professor Peter Edelman has been on the faculty of Georgetown Law School since 1982. He was previously the Associate Dean of the Law Center at Georgetown University, and he clerked for Supreme Court Justice Arthur Goldberg. We're talking about the John Roberts hearings this week and the general consensus that he's a shoo-in and that the battle is being deferred to the replacement of Justice O'Connor. Nevertheless, if you wouldn't mind going through, I know one of the first things that he established was that he was in favor of the idea. He acknowledged that there was a right to privacy. That's obviously what doomed Bork. And even it's worth noting that Justice Thomas, in his hearing, acknowledged a right of privacy, but then turned around and voted against the Texas sodomy case. So you don't know what you're getting. But give me an idea of what you think is a portent of going back not just 75 years, but going back to the previous, one century.
Well, let's talk about the privacy question first for a minute, because Judge Roberts did acknowledge that there is a right of privacy for some purposes contained through the 14th Amendment. He was very careful not to say that that meant anything in terms of his commitment to uphold Roe v. Wade. The most he would say is that the law as it is on the books now, with the Casey decision following up on Roe v. Wade, that the court had specifically decided then on the basis of stare decisis, meaning precedent, meaning reliance on past decisions. He said that that meant that the principle had been established. And then almost in the very next sentence in that same colloquy, if you read the transcript, he talked about another case in another area where the Supreme Court had overruled itself after just a few years. And that was clearly giving himself a trap door to say, of course, the court has within its power and sometimes does use it to overrule previous precedents. So, number one, the reference to the right of privacy never included in his formulation a specific endorsement of that meaning, that there's a right of women to choose whether or not to carry a child to term. And secondly, he specifically, in the same breath almost, talked about the fact that the court on occasion overrules things. So I don't find that a very strong point for anyone to lean on. In terms of the rest of the record, you know, in the 80s he talked about the intent test under the Voting Rights Act, which is extremely important in the effectiveness of the Voting Rights Act. He called that a radical experiment. And there were propositions to amend the Fair Housing Act to make it more effective. He called that government intrusion. He expressed doubt that there was a problem with pay equity for women. He called it a canard. I mean, this is a very cramped view of individual rights and liberties. Essentially, it strongly implies that laws that are on the books, he did oppose at the time, and that if they come up in a constitutional context, he may well translate that view into constitutional decision-making. One of the things that troubles me a lot is a whole bunch of things that conservatives have stood for that relate to whether you or I can get access to the courts for resolution of a problem. He advocated in the 1980s that jurisdiction should be taken away from the federal courts, the Supreme Court and lower federal courts, about school segregation, about prayer in the public schools, about abortion. Now, that's his predecessor, Chief Justice Rehnquist, was a fierce defender of the independence of the courts in this current time of attack, mindless attack that's occurring from various people. And here's a man who rather blithely, if you look at the record, was saying it was constitutional and he was advocating it to pass legislation to cut down on the courts being open to people. So you go on through, and there's a recent decision as a judge, a vote that he took on something on the Endangered Species Act, the so-called hapless toad case, where he implies that he would reexamine the power of the national government to reach around the country so as to protect ordinary people from various kinds of overreaching. That one implies really a concern that would take us back to the pre-New Deal court. So those are some of the examples. It's civil rights, it's civil liberties, it's access to the courts, it's the Commerce Clause, and it's really about whether you take the kind of view of the Constitution that we've developed with great struggle over a period of two centuries, or whether you have a different view that really is much narrower about individual rights and liberties and government power to protect people.
But I suppose the more, you know, just to be pragmatic, the real question would be, is he worse than Rehnquist on any and all of these issues? And I think what you learn from the hearings is, in a de facto way, you realize that what radical Scalia and Thomas are. I mean, it seems to me that's the amazing thing, is that he came across well because he wasn't as radical as they are.
He was apparently not. You know, again, you have to separate the style, which was very congenial, the performance, which was extremely intelligent, you know, sitting there without a note, not taking a note, not bringing a note, that's really quite impressive. You have to separate all of that from the substance and figure out what we know and what we don't know about the substance. So I actually don't think, it sounds like he's somewhat more in terms just of his tone, of a Rehnquist style conservative, which is very conservative, by the way, and maybe not the same as Scalia and Thomas, but we really don't know that. And that's so frustrating here. And I think what we do know, based on his record, is in fact very worrisome. And I hope senators will really pore over that record between now and Thursday when they vote. And I know that they are. You know, Senator Feinstein said on Thursday when I was up there testifying that she had all of his decisions as a Court of Appeals judge, and she was going to take them home and read every one of them over the weekend. I think that's a good thing for her to do.
Well, but you know, at what point though does ideology give way to politics? I mean, look at Rehnquist's main thrust of his 35 years on the court. He was a zealous advocate for states' rights, and the feeling is that if they do overturn Roe v. Wade, that will be the rubric that they'll kick it back to the states. But it's worth noting, in spite of Rehnquist's commitment to states' rights over his long tenure, when it came to Bush v. Gore after the 2000 elections, he didn't seem to feel that there was any contradiction there, you know.
Yes. What's more than worth noting, it's a rather critical point. Yeah. And the same for Justice O'Connor, by the way, who I admire in some respects, but that was a black day for the Supreme Court and really for the United States, because you know, I always have trouble telling my students that constitutional law is a principled effort in which there are differences of view about how to do it between one view of the text and the history and the traditions and the other, but that it's not lawless. And then I have to explain Bush v. Gore. So that's very hard, and it's always going to be true that, you know, from now throughout history, that law students will look at Bush v. Gore and say, what do you mean there are principles?
Well, on that note, I guess we'll wait this week for what looks like an inevitable confirmation, but obviously, there is a possibility of a major fight coming up if the president chooses somebody that's not as moderate, if that's the correct way of describing Justice O'Connor.
Yes, and I would add, if we just have 10 more seconds, that I think it's important that there be a substantial debate in the country, which is led off by these current confirmation hearings, but that we, all of us who care about the Supreme Court, which should be all of us, really, really try to have the kind of attention to the Constitution that we had for a brief moment during the Bork confirmation hearings in the 1980s, because it does affect all of us, and we haven't had that debate really in a full way since that time.
But if the president does choose somebody in the mold of Scalia or Thomas to fill the vacancy created by Justice O'Connor's retirement, then all that's left is the filibuster.
Well, we'll see. You know, it just depends who he sends up, whether it's something that, in fact, is someone so overtly radically conservative that some of the Republicans, like Senator Snowe and Senator Chafee, also agree that it's unacceptable. So we'll see what happens, whether there are 51 votes or just how many votes there are. And in any case, there's elections in 2006 and in 2008, and, you know, if it's palpable that what President Bush has actually done is to turn the Supreme Court into a radically different institution, albeit by the forthcoming forward looking backward action of 5-4, that is going forward, that it's 5-4 for these radically conservative positions, that should be a political issue in the next election cycles.
Well, the women are on the bench, and obviously the president's wife has signaled heavily that she wants a woman, and there's a feeling that perhaps they will replace O'Connor with a woman.
Yes. Well,
the people on the bench are all very, very, very conservative.
Exactly. I was just going to say that. The names that have been mentioned are all people who are, from everything we can tell, and they have records, recent records of decision-making, that they're in that mold of what we referred to as Scalia and Thomas. So if that's the case, then perhaps we'll get that very, very lively debate in the very near future. In any case, I think it's important that it be more part of the electoral process than it has been.
I thank you for joining us in Los Angeles, Professor Peter Edelman. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Hello again, I'm Ian Masters. I'm just speaking there with Professor Peter Edelman, who has been on the faculty of Georgetown Law School since 1982, and he's also the Associate Dean of the Law Center at Georgetown, and he clerk for Supreme Court Justice Arthur Goldberg. I'm now speaking with James Paul, who's been the Executive Director of the Global Policy Forum since its foundation in 1993, and since 1997 he has served as the chair of the NGO, that's the Non-Governmental Organization Working Group, on the United Nations Security Council. And this week, of course, there was expectation that this would be a big moment for the UN. There was also previous to this, there was a lot of the agenda that had been worked out was the United States sort of threw a cat amongst the pigeon at the last minute with hundreds and hundreds of changes. It seems that at the last minute the president sort of backed off a little bit. But in general, it's very difficult, I think, to get a sense of what was achieved in terms of expectations and delivery. Where would you rate the happenings last week?
Well, Ian, it's good to be with you. The summit certainly didn't produce a document that anybody was very happy with. You're right in mentioning the United States. The U.S. Had been involved in negotiations for several months. They were part of that process, and then suddenly John Bolton, the U.S. ambassador, insisted on hundreds of changes. That was about 2.5 weeks before the actual opening of the summit, in which 150 or 160 heads of state and government were supposed to be coming to New York, so it was pretty clear that Washington wanted to wreck that summit, and I think you could say in many ways they did.
And did you feel that, as some of the people in the press did, that the president actually wasn't as confrontational and dismissive as he normally is, and limiting the agenda to only to anti-terrorism? He did thank the world for their response to Katrina, and didn't seem to be quite as monomaniacal about terrorism.
Well, that's true, but you know, politicians sometimes speak in one way and act in another. And George Bush, if you look at his record overall, and if you look at what they actually did in the run-up to the summit, I don't think you see anything, any reason to think that this administration is very favorably disposed towards the UN or to any kind of multilateral process. I mean, they actually pretty much wrecked the Glen Eagles summit of the G8 when there was only seven other great powers around the table. Here there was 191, and they're really much more negative about the UN.
Well, it's clear that the president comes out of, given the domination of his foreign policy by the neoconservatives, and all of the neoconservatives come out of Heritage or the American Enterprise Institute, which is their think tanks, both of whom have an obsession against the United Nations that doesn't appear to be even rational at times. Yet, continually, polls show that up to 80% of the American people support the United Nations, the United States' engagement with the United Nations. So why does this radical fringe dominate the debate and get so many headlines? And why do they influence our president? I mean, not that that I know. I suspect I know the answer to that, but anyway.
Well, I think that's really that is definitely the key question. But I think the answer is not to be found in just with the neoconservatives and the Heritage Foundation, because if you go back into previous administrations, you look at the Clinton administration, for instance, where you don't have neoconservatives in the saddle, you find a lot of coolness towards, if not even hostility towards, the UN, working around the UN, working across purposes to the UN. The fact of the matter is that the United States, as the global superpower, is not very keen on having any institution or process second-guessing what do the U.S. Leaders think should be their policy. And that applies to international law, and that applies to the International Court of Justice, and it applies to the various treaties and the way in which those treaties have been enforced or not enforced. So I think there's something more fundamental and structural about this, and it has to do with the role of the U.S. in the world. And it's not, unfortunately, it's not just the neocons, but certainly the neocons present the most extreme view of this.
Yeah, but there's a deep illogic, James Paul, to this anti-UN obsession and bias. On the part of the militia movement, it's totally delusional. The black helicopters and world government, that's just as far from reality as you could possibly get. But nevertheless, people like John Ashcroft shared those views. So you can't have it both ways. You can't believe that the United Nations is some great omnipotent dark force that flies around at night in black helicopters. At the same time, the other bias against it is that it's ineffectual. So, so make up your mind, you know.
That's right. But I don't think it is the black helicopter people and militias in the hills of Idaho that are deciding this policy of the United States government. I think it's the leadership in Washington, and I think it goes, as I say, I believe it goes across the parties to a certain extent. And but I think you also have to open up the pages of the Wall Street Journal to understand that big business in the United States is very hostile to the UN.
Why?
And well, because the UN is seen as a break on or as a regulator of international business.
Because of human rights and
well, it's if you look at all the different pieces of the UN. UN, whether it be about human rights or the International Labor Organization with its approach to workers' rights, and the International Health Organization with its concern about pharmaceuticals, about tobacco. The tobacco companies hate them because they have a big campaign on that. They have a big campaign on obesity and food, which the food companies don't like. The whole campaign about infant formula, again, that's a Nestle. That was one of the biggest international food company was targeted. So, I mean, I think you could see how virtually in every sector there's some way in which the UN is defending the interests of the world's peoples, but is doing it in a way that the big companies don't like. So this is a mood in big business worldwide against regulation, against the interference of governments, and certainly against the interference of international bodies of any kind.
So, in other words, the administration is not grandstanding for the rubes and the isolationists. They're actually in complicity with the predatory practices of multinational corporations.
That's it. And I think that then you can see how it makes much more sense, because what militia has ever influenced the U.S. government?
Well, except for the misreading of the Second Amendment, that the state shall have well-regulated militias and the citizens' right to bear arms should not be infringed.
Yeah.
So, James Paul, again, you're the executive director of the Global Policy Forum, and you've been since 1997 served as the chair of the NGO, non-governmental organization, working group on the Security Council. One of the great tragedies about this misapplied and counterintuitive and counterproductive war on terror that the president has been pursuing in reaction to the 9/11 4 years ago, clearly it's blowing up in our face, and in fact the terrorists are getting stronger and more numerous, and the Iraq war has turned into a vortex that's sucking money, energy, life and goodwill out of the United States and its reputation in the world community. One of the things that other critics of this unilateral approach that the President Bush has taken is that there is a whole universe of NGOs out there that, you know, you can't fight ideas with guns, and at the end of the day we have this war against fundamentalism has to be won by other means, and the argument is that in other words, we shouldn't be the State Department should be taking the lead. AID, the Peace Corps, they're the people that have a chance of winning this war of ideas, and that to buttress them, we should be encouraging the NGOs who are already out there in the field. What's your sense from being there at the United Nations, right there in the cockpit in terms of this issue? Is there any learning curve on the part of our administration about how important NGOs are in this a more functional way to fight the war on terror? And is this, Bush's other mother, who's now at the State Department, Karen Hughes, is she going to have any influence in that direction?
Well, of course, it depends a little bit on how you see the issue of the war on terrorism anyway. I mean, I tend to see this whole thing as being a very hyped-up matter.
Mm-hmm. It's true.
It's a search of enemies,
right? But the long and the short of it is, what they're doing is making things worse, not better. So
yeah, but it's not just about terrorism. It's about the whole planet we live in and the way it's functioning.
Mm-hmm.
Whether you look at the international financial system or the cooperation or lack thereof on health matters and so on, the environment. I mean, there's a lot of ways in which the world we live in is a dangerous place. And it's not just about some nasty man with a beard and a turban who's planning to, sneak an atomic weapon into Grand Central Station. I mean, this is about the way the world's environment is very, very seriously in degradation, and other things like that. And those can, but the problem is that in Washington they want to run it all from there, and so the UN they see as a place where people are going to be second guessing them, that mm-hmm. whether it be the Europeans or.
Right.
Or smaller, poor countries or whatever, there's going to be other ideas about how the whole thing ought to operate. And
well,
then that's something they want to avoid.
I thank you so much for joining us. I'm sorry we've run out of time. James Paul, who's the executive director of the Global Policy Forum and has been the chair of the NGO working group of the United Nations Security Council since 1997. I thank Louis Vandenberg, the producer, Jazz Shepherd, the engineer, Rusty Wynn, and Carol Cuth, the assistant producer.